HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan, announcing show number 178, recorded live Thursday, September 3rd, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks about the Visual Studio plugin CodeRush with Mark Miller.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And I'm sitting down today with Mark Miller from Developer Express, the famous architect of CodeRush and Refactor. How's it going, Mark?
It's going well, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm not doing too bad.
Good.
I wanted to talk to you because I got an interesting email from a guy who was trying to decide whether he would use CodeRush or a tool called ReSharper. And both of these tools plug into Visual Studio and change it in some fundamental way. Could you maybe start by explaining what your tool does, and then your competitor ReSharper is kind of a similar thing. And the reason I bring up ReSharper is that CodeRush is kind of my favorite and kind of my favorite little tool like this. But I'm interested in how you write something like this. So let's talk about first what it does, and then I want to get into some technical details about what exactly you had to do to make it happen.
Okay. Well, the essence behind CodeRush is to help you write code, see the code, navigate through the code faster. So it's essentially visualization, code creation, and navigation are the main areas that it helps you with. And anything that kind of falls into those categories, including kind of I guess what I would call outside-of-the-box ideas in terms of how we can make people write code faster are certainly considered, and if they're useful and functional and efficient, they're put into the product. So the product kind of encapsulates those things. To give you some more specific examples, part of the product is refactoring tools. So CodeRush includes Refactor Pro, which has about 185 refactorings in it that cover a lot of all the languages we support: C++, C#, Visual Basic, JavaScript, ASP.NET. So you've got refactorings in all those areas and more. XAML too. I should mention XAML as well. And then in addition to the refactorings, you've got code declaration tools. So if you need to do, if you're doing like TDD development or consume first development, where you write the consumption code first, then based on clues at the consumption code, we can then make the declarations for you. A simple example is if you have like my instance dot my new property equals false, you can declare my new property as a Boolean type there. It's a simple example, but they of course can get very, very complex and sophisticated, where the inference in terms of the type based on the assignment is evaluated at while you're working and writing the code.
Okay. So let me interrupt your advertisement because I want to talk about that's a lot of stuff. So your tool does everything. It's like a Swiss Army knife, but it's to be clear to people who maybe haven't used tools like this before, it's living inside Visual Studio.
Right.
Right. This whole thing's in process. There's no little coderush.exe that pops out, right?
Right. And to make it, make things more intelligent, like for example, if I have an assignment to something, I need to actually evaluate that assignment at design time, essentially while you're writing the code, not at runtime. And so we have to have a sophisticated, ability to do that. And it's essentially the same as what IntelliSense uses inside of Visual Studio to be able to infer types and, mm-hmm. and things like that. So there's a lot going on in the background while you're working. And yes, it is inside of Visual Studio.
So go ahead. Where do you hook in? I mean, This has been working since 2003 or 2005?
Since 2002. We shipped it in 2003, but it was working for 2002 when we shipped it in 2003. So since the very first version of Visual Studio for .NET. And, mm-hmm. and it hooks in through, the add-in technology and the vSIP package technology. And
vSIP is a Visual Studio integration partner or integration something?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's integration program or partners or something like that. Okay. I think that's what it is. Yeah. But basically it's a sophisticated way to hook into Visual Studio and extend it. And so that's the first entry point. And then there's a number of other points where we connect in the versions of Visual Studio up through 2008, because we do some things that VSIP does not allow, like painting on the editor, for example. So when you, for example, do a refactoring like inline temp, where it takes a temporary variable and inlines it, you'll see us paint on the editor. We'll cross out the declaration for the temporary variable and give you a little indication that that's going to be moving down.
Okay. So I want to dig into this. So forgive me a little bit as I steer you around, because I know you've got, if you haven't met Mark Miller, he has a massive head and a huge amount of information inside said head. And it can be very tricky, because the man has a huge amount of information he wants to get out very quickly. Yeah, so usually, Mark, we know each other well enough. I think you'll forgive me if I steer.
No, you're fine. I usually jump in the middle anyway.
I want to understand. I've written little add-ins before. And by little add-ins, I mean, I've added a menu, I've added a button, and things like that. And this is all using the older COM-based stuff. I think it was called iExtensibility 2 or something like that. Is that right?
ENVDTE is, I think, what I'm familiar with. The Environment
DTE. DTE, right.
Yeah, that's
right.
The object you work with.
DTE.
Right. Yes. Yep.
Wow, DTE, that's really old.
Yeah, I think it's Design Time Environment, maybe. I'm not sure even what that – I don't remember what it stands for.
So right. You've got – you get your plugin at a very, very low level. And you kind of get your hooks into Visual Studio, not at the level that I was doing, where it's like add a toolbar, but it's at some more fundamental level. And you really start messing around with a lot of stuff. You have to, like you said, paint to the,
right?
You know, paint on. Do they want you painting on the text editor? Or is there an official way to do that, or are you just doing it?
Well, there's not an official way to do it, but they do want us to do it because, you know, we add value to Visual Studio. I say they want us to. I think maybe unofficially they want us to do that. Because it adds value. It adds excitement. People are like, you know, hey, can I do that too? And it actually, I think, significantly influenced the direction of Visual Studio 2010 based on what we could do in 2008, what we were able to do. So, you know, yes, we hook in using the officially sanctioned mechanisms. You use the term mess around, and I would replace that with carefully constructing a safety net. That's what I would replace that worth with.
Well, that's a good point, because you're doing things that are really out there in the sense of animations painting on a scrolling background that you really have no business painting on, because they don't give you, like you said, no official hooks to say,
right,
paint a pretty arrow over this XML comment.
Right. So to make all this work, there's a lot of things going on in the background that can compose this safety net that I'm talking about. So for example, up through 2008, we've got subclassing going on. So we subclass the window. We see when Windows messages are coming in, and based on what messages come through, that actually goes in and influences the safety net in terms of what we're showing you. The other thing is, just figuring out the positions of all the characters on the screen. For example, in that example I mentioned earlier where I talked about inline temp and we do a strike through, we cross out the declaration. Well, we have to know exactly where that declaration is on the screen in order to get that, nail that correctly. And there are actually a lot of subtleties in terms of getting that calculation right, because the font can change and other factors can change as well that change line height and character position. So there was a lot of challenging stuff that we had to write. I remember when this was some of the first stuff we did, Scott, and as I recall, it took us like a good 3 weeks of solid development time before we got to a point where we felt like we accurately knew where all the characters were on screen.
So let me interrupt for a second, because this is a significant thing that if you're not familiar with CodeRush or tools like it, as you can probably figure it out by now, it really integrates with the IDE and does a lot of stuff such that it's kind of fundamental to the experience. One of the things that I like about CodeRush, and I say this as a, just so the listener understands, I've been a fanboy and a friend of yours for a million years, and I've been, I tell people about CodeRush, but you don't have any, CodeRush has no relationship with the podcast. You guys don't give me a sack of money. Actually, you have never given me anything ever. You've actually taken things from me, Mark. But we have no relationship. I'm not trying to.
Right. I let you write a Segway word once, and that was about it. That was about it.
So I think you got me a Diet Coke one time.
Did I?
No, that was at
a conference from a free vending.
It was a free Diet Coke.
Oh, yeah, the free one. Yeah.
Point I'm making is that I'm a fan of CodeRush no more. I just want to make sure that you understand that I'm talking about this because I think it's interesting. But what's interesting about CodeRush is that there's a lot of what people will call eye candy. but mm-hmm. I call it good user interface and user experience design. One of the things that code, like one of the examples that I want to understand, and maybe you can walk me through this, is that you've got a lot of these refactorings.
Right.
One of them is reorder parameters.
Sure.
So when I want to blow somebody's mind with CodeRush, I go over to a function and I've got int A, string Y, date Z.
As the parameters, right?
Yeah. As parameters to the method.
Yep.
And I put the cursor over it and I hit the, what I call the, you know, the refactor button.
Yep.
I think it's tilde A on my machine because it's a button I never push.
Right.
Then suddenly those three parameters get highlighted. And I can use the left arrow and the mount and the right arrow to move them, to reorder them. So that right. in itself is interesting.
Yeah, actually only one of those parameters is highlighted, but you get arrows showing you which way you can move it. And then
right,
you hit the arrow keys and they move. Right.
So then I can move left and right and those parameters will move. So that I can go X, Y, Z, Z, Y, X.
Right.
You know, yay. Well, we're on an audio podcast, so you can't see this, but literally if I hit the right arrow, the int X will jump up and make a little froggy hop over to where string Y is, and then string Y will rush away while A is simultaneously jumping over. So it's this completely unexpected experience.
Right, this animation moves them. You see them actually move. The text actually moves smoothly as they exchange positions.
Right, and for old-timers on the show, it always made me think of the CD-ROMs of the early 90s, where it was like Myst or these kind of things, where it was like you'd have a video, you'd have a plain background, which in this case is the text editor, and then you'd have a video maybe inside of a picture frame on the wall or whatever. And they were using these tricks where the video was seamlessly integrated,
or at least
as best they could. You
right.
know what I'm talking?
Yeah.
It's like QuickTime pops up in a 320 by 240 hole. And they try to make
sure.
it look like the whole screen is active, but it's
yeah,
not.
But it's only
just
that little
area.
Yeah, that's to some degree a similar trick that what we're doing there. We're painting directly on the window, right on that, mm-hmm. on that GDAI, canvas. And we're doing that at we're animating. So we're doing it, updating it pretty frequently. But mm-hmm. we're also taking care of a lot of other things. For example, if you have word wrapping turned on, we need to know where that's going to go. Right? And that might be an option. Like, for example, in VB, having word wrapping on is not that uncommon of an option to have. And so we have to support word wrapping. And we also have to support what happens if you're changing positions with another parameter that's off screen, right? Because if it's off screen, we need to actually scroll horizontally so you can now see the new position. So it's a combination, Scott, of that kind of painting trick, but also being aware of where everything is and scrolling if necessary to make that happen. And I want to throw in why we do this, right? Because it's like,
it's
this kind of, whenever I see eye candy, my first thought is, I consider it as a possibility. Is that really, did we just really make eye candy, or is there some functional, purpose behind it? And usually, I get past the first question pretty quickly with, oh no, there is a functional purpose. And in this case, there is. If we take away that animation and we mm-hmm. move instantly, it's hard to see what just happened.
Right,
unless you totally are expecting it, right? If you say, oh, I know what's going to happen and I hit the key and instantly it jumps, then you're maybe okay and comfortable with that. But if we show you the animation, then it totally confirms visually what just happened. In fact, if you look at new UIs that are coming out, like, for example, I like looking at the iPhone UI a lot, and they've got animation all over the place there. If I delete, for example, a picture, I actually see the picture kind of get sucked down into the garbage can, right, for example, on the iPhone. Mm-hmm. So it's this, somebody worked on this animation, and the reason they did it is because it serves a purpose. It's not simply eye candy. You get a confirmation that the piece was deleted, and you feel good about it because you actually saw it go down right. into the trash can, just like it happens in real life when you throw stuff away.
Yeah, that is an interesting idea. What would happen if when I was throwing trash away in real life, I picked up my arm and I threw the trash and then the paper disappeared from my hand and into the trash? It might take me a second to go, okay, wait a second, where's the paper? Oh, it's in the trash.
Right. In fact, if here's the thing. Now we do actually support, like, say, for example, you have many parameters. You want to take the first one, move it to the end. Let's say mm-hmm. you hit that right arrow key, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, really fast like that. We actually do jump it as fast as you hit it. But if you just hit it once and you don't hit the key again.
Oh, I didn't know you did that. So you're saying that if you detect that I'm hitting the key really fast, you'll go, oh, he's in a hurry. I'll turn off the animation for now.
Yeah. It took us a while to figure this out and to get it to a point where it felt perfect for everybody. And this was one of these last, kind of the last things we added is when we realized that some people knew in advance they wanted to move it like three or four over, they hit it and they were waiting. And so we took that away so they didn't have to wait. And getting that balance right so that there was still animation if it made sense and not animation at all if it didn't make sense was a little bit tricky. But I think we've nailed it on there. Speaking of UI in the code, the my favorite is for rename, and it's a real simple refactoring. But you, what's cool about it is you get this inline experience, right? You say I want to rename this, and you can select a portion of the identifier and hit rename, and then that piece remains selected, and you just type in the new replacement for it, and it renames all the corresponding references to that identifier everywhere throughout the code. And it's very fast as well. So if you, even if you've got an identifier that's showing up in, you know, tens of thousands of places inside of your source code, you still have this instantaneous experience where you are able to edit and rename right there live in the code. The commit is also something we had to work out. When do we commit to this? You know, how do we know you've committed? Because normally when you bring up a dialogue, we know you commit by hitting OK.
Hey everybody, this is Scott coming at you from another place in time. No doubt you probably bump into testing tasks now and then in your work, and you know writing functional tests is probably not your favorite thing. It's kind of difficult, takes time, and the results can be dubious. Well, get ready to start liking tests thanks to Telerik with the new WebEye testing framework. Building web automation tests is a breeze. You've got code automation with advanced ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight applications. You can write a single test, have it executed against multiple browsers at once. You benefit from a rich API. There's link support, integration with Visual Studio unit testing, also NUnit, XUnit, and MBUnit, not to mention the free wrappers for Telerik RAD controls for ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight, all shipping with Telerik's new testing tool. One of the best features, the WebEye testing framework, which is developed by Art of Test, is it's absolutely free. If you've already got hooked on WebEye testing framework, start using it right away. Go to Telerik.com for more info. Thanks a lot.
Well, yeah, right. And let me interrupt because this is the thing that's the very thing that's significant about not just Code Rush as a product, but your style. And I think it's a different style than typical is that if one was going to tip, you know, if I was going to sit down today and Scott Hanselman's going to write a refactoring tool, I'd hook up some hotkey, I'd push a button to do a rename, and I'd probably pop a dialog box.
Right.
And I would tell them the name of the text underneath the cursor, and I would, and they would spend this time in this modal dialogue. And
right.
By modal, that means that they're stuck. It's basically forcing their attention.
And it changes the view, right? Instead of looking at the code, you're looking at a picture, a representation of the thing you want to change. Same thing with reorder parameters. I mean, most people bring up a dialogue with a list of parameters and buttons that you have to press up and down, right? Mm-hmm. So you're reaching for the mouse to click on those buttons because they usually don't have hotkeys on them. And it's a total, from my perspective, it's a total interruption in the flow. And you're right. My style is like no modal dialogues. I want to get all the UI flat down into the source code. So if there's an opportunity, if there's an interactive point, if a refactoring requires interactivity, we do everything we can to make that interactivity at the level of the code that you're looking at. So you're right there working in it.
And so you never leave the editor.
That's our goal, right? Yeah.
That's insane. You're insane. I mean, that's insane though. I mean, the amount of work that you must have done to get.
Right.
Well, painting on the editor, like all those things you were describing that you needed to know about word wrap and what font they're using. You know, if you did that wrong, and I'm sure at some point it didn't work while you were in the process of doing the coding, you must have been off by a few pixels or you'd have visual glitches. It must have been very irritating.
Well, I think a lot of people on the team thought I was insane when I was telling them how we were going to do rename. And there was a fair amount of pushback, but because I was leading the team, there was, you know, it was ineffective. They couldn't stop it from happening. I said, no, we're going to do it. And then afterwards, when they started seeing, you know, the reaction and they started kind of understanding what was going on, then it's like there's no more pushback on anything, right? But I think it's unusual even for the team to have that kind of pushback, right? But that was definitely the case with reorder parameters because, you know, I was saying, no, we have to animate. We need to move it. We need to show people that it's moving. But it is kind of a unique style, but the payoff is there from a customer satisfaction standpoint. Mm-hmm. If you use this and try it and then you go try it, you know, the old way, the modal way or, you know, something without animation, you definitely realize something is missing. And when you realize that you're thinking about you're not thinking about coding when you're using that other interface, you're thinking about why it's not as good as it could be. So it is insane and it does take a lot more effort. But, you know, the one thing though that we've done, Scott, is, for example, like to do those strike-throughs. You know, our strike-throughs, I actually take a lot of pride in the strike-through. If you look closely at that, it actually looks like somebody took a pen and drew across the code and actually was lifting up the pen, you know, felt tip pen as they got to the end. It actually gets thinner and it's slightly translucent, you know, as it, and it curves.
It looks like someone actually took a pen on your screen and then struck out a you know, like an editor.
Right.
Like a red pen that someone would use when you wrote a paper for English class.
Right. But strike.
It doesn't just look like a line.
Yeah.
It looks like a felt pen.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, though, a strike through is a very common kind of preview markup thing that we do. And so we've got, you know, consequently, we've got methods that come in our event org. So we've got, like, when we write a refactoring, one of our events is prepare preview. And the preview is what comes up when you're hovering over a menu item or you've got it selected with the arrow keys and you're about to hit enter on that menu item for the refactoring, for example, rename or reorder parameters or something like that. And what we'll do is in that event handler for the refactoring, that prepare preview, we have an opportunity to actually paint on the editor. Well, the event args have got something that says add strike through, and we simply just give it a range of code, and we can even give it multiple lines of code, and that's all we need to do, and it'll draw the strike through there intelligently. It'll only draw it over code. It will ignore white space. And so it's a simple one call kind of thing. So it's, and it's very fast and easy to do. So if you want to write your own refactoring, you handle this event and you make that call right in the event args. It's event args dot, you know, add strike through. And that's it. You're done. So even though, yes, there's been a lot of work and kind of insane amount of, you know, preparation almost to make this so that we can, you know, do these, you know, beautiful things on the editor, this eye candy or, you know, what ease of use, whatever you want to call it. We've made it so that our developers and people who extend it can access that easily. So now we're at a point where we're simply, it's just, we have nothing but a lot to gain from all that work.
Is this because, I mean, is this a matter of, like, you know, what is it they say? I think this was an old joke that any technology, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Right, yeah.
That's one thing. Sure. Another one was that any problem in computer science can be solved by one additional layer of indirection. Therefore, any sufficiently advanced technology required several layers of interaction. I mean, you've really layered this thing such that this COM interface and the low-level GDI stuff is a distant memory.
It's far away. It really is. If you were to ask me, you know, to sit me down and have me do a quiz on this, I would probably fail it, you know, spectacularly.
So you wrote that engine like we were talking about where letters are, where things wrap. That right. was figured out with magic and buried long ago?
Yeah, I think so. To some degree it is, although that code's being resurrected now as we move to 2010. Because, you know, we're no longer in GDI world, we're in WPF world.
And so let's just take a moment. I just want to make sure, because I always want to make sure that when we use a three-letter acronym or a TLA, that people know what that means. So GDI is the graphics device interface. That's the way that we've been painting in Windows since time began.
Right.
And then WPF is the Windows Presentation Foundation. And the thing that I think you're alluding to is that the editor and most of Visual Studio changed from GDI, the 25-year-old technology, to WPF, a newer technology. And the entire editor swapped out from underneath you.
Yeah, it did. Well, kind of. I mean, they have some of the old editor is still there, but we kind of consider that dangerous to work with in 2010. They provided shims and stuff and things like that. But our goal is to go all with the new interfaces for 2010. But we also have the goal of making it so that our plugins simply just need to be recompiled and without any changes to them. And for the most part, I think all of our refactoring plugins will meet that criteria. We'll simply just need to rebuild them and they'll work.
So they will need to be rebuilt.
Yes. But even what's cool about that is those plugins are making calls, right, to, like, you know, add strike through. They're not directly painting on the editor. They don't really have a canvas that they're working with or, you know, a graphics object. They don't have a graphics object that they're working with. They simply make that call through the event args, right, to add strike through or to add insert point or, you know, draw arrow, that sort of thing. That is all done in the refactorings. And so we've already kind of, even in the refactorings, we've kind of decoupled away GDI to some degree, mm-hmm. right, already in there. And so, and then our goal is to do the same with everything else. There are some plugins that actually do work with a graphics object in GDI, and so those plugins will have to be changed a bit. But what we're doing actually is we are actually something kind of interesting is we're making it we're creating a an abstraction layer over both WPF and GDI so that all of our plugins can ultimately be in one source code base. And then, you know, depending on what engine is installed, it'll either work in 2010 or 2008 and below. And that's very cool from a plugin writer standpoint because you write it once and then it works on all the others. It also has the possibility, this is not any kind of promise, but it's certainly technically possible that if we could move CodeRush to a completely different platform that had a different kind of drawing mechanism on it that wasn't mm-hmm. GDI, wasn't WPF, and it would still work.
So you're saying that really when a plugin writer, a CodeRush plugin writer writes something, there's the surface area they sit on is entirely CodeRush. You don't let Visual Studio leak out at all.
Well, they can get to it. Like if they ask for something that we don't support, that is supported through like ENV, DTE, or VSIP, we say go around us. But for the most part, they really don't need it. In many cases, we're better too. Like for example, one of the things that just came to mind is the way we represent source code to plugin writers is a really neat way. We give them a tree and they can modify that tree, that parse tree, and then give the tree back and then we can generate code with that. Whereas with Visual Studio, it's two different mechanisms. If you want to generate code, you use one mechanism. If you want to understand code, it's a different mechanism. Plus, there's not been agreement from the Visual Studio, the different language teams at Visual Studio. There's not been agreement over how to universally represent, source code. And so what happens is you get to a point where everybody's represented the same way. You have like classes and then you have methods and you have parameters. And then after that, we stop. There's no inside of methods that's available if you're just going to use the extensibility mechanisms that come out of Microsoft. And that's one of the cool things about the DX Core, which both CodeRush and Refactor are built on. And the DX Core is this free extensibility engine that the extensibility engine we use and we make free for other developers to download and use as well, is the DX Core gives you this really sweet universal way of modifying, working with code and understanding it and maybe modifying it as well. And the cool thing about this, Scott, is that all of our refactorings are written in without any checks to see what language we're working in. So there's no check to see, are we in Visual Basic? Are we in C Sharp? We just simply take the tree, we manipulate it and hand it back and then generate the code. We might make checks with regard to the active language to say, hey, does the active language support a with block, for example? And if it was JavaScript, it would say yes. And if it was Visual Basic, it would say yes. And if it was C Sharp and C++, it would say no. But we ask the active language questions about what it supports, and that may influence how we generate the code. We might take advantage of a feature, for example, of a language feature if it's there. But there's nothing in our code that checks to see what language is out there. So as a result, when you write a refactoring or if you write some code declaration piece or something that's maybe calculating metrics, you don't really have to worry about what language you're working with, and it works with all the languages we support after you compile it. So that's another cool thing about this. That's actually the way it should be in Visual Studio as well, but we're just not at a point yet there. We're not at a point yet where we can universally represent all languages in one mm-hmm. way, and that's something DX Core does do.
How much have you had to do that you shouldn't have had to do? Like how much I mean, do you have a little C Sharp compiler and you're off compiling C Sharp and you're off compiling VB in memory to think? How much did you have to parse?
Yeah, we do have parsers for all the languages, and we also have code generation aspects of it as well. So we have something similar to language services that, you know, Visual Studio has language services. So like there's a C Sharp language service and the VB language service, and those things are responsible for compiling and parsing and IntelliSense, things like that. We have a similar structure as well to our framework where we have language services essentially, and ours are responsible for parsing, for code generation, and also for, the rules of resolving types, finding out where types are located. For example, in one language, we might find types by going through the imports or using statements from top to bottom. And in another language, it might go from like bottom to top. It might say the most recently imported one in reference is going to be the first one I check, for example. And so those rules sometimes differ from language to language. And so we'll put in some code there that helps out in terms of resolving types in when we create a new language service. But those are the three components. Oh, and actually there's a fourth one. The fourth one is essentially the description of the language, which is essentially a whole bunch of properties that describe, you know, like, for example, does this language support with blocks, for example?
Okay.
And so we'll fill all those out, like yes or no. We'll answer those questions, all the way down the board for that language. And so when that language is active and we're modifying it, we can go out and find out what it supports.
What do you think the future of this is? I mean, how far can you take this whole thing?
Well, actually, no, I just realized I didn't answer your last question. Let me answer that question. And the question was, how much did we write that we shouldn't have had to write? And I really, my answer to that, I think, is pretty much zero, Scott. And the reason why is because if it's hard to do what we're doing, that gives us a competitive advantage. If it's hard to paint on the editor, that gives us a competitive advantage. And so we'll take any competitive advantage we can get, right? If there's something that is widely considered impossible and we figured out a way to do it, we'll take that. So I'm all over those kinds of challenges. So my answer to the question is zero. Your next question was, what do I see for the future of this? Well, I think that, you know, the UI has still got a long ways to go in for most tools that are out there, including Visual Studio. I think that this flattened, you know, experience where I'm renaming right inside the editor, it's a really slick, good feeling. I feel like after I've renamed, I feel good, right? Because I've done it in the fewest keystrokes possible. I haven't distracted myself from my focus, which is writing code. And I haven't slowed down my momentum at all. That's kind of the goal in this. So I think UI's got some place, you know, room to grow in the UI area. And also I think in the area of finding out what is, you know, what's wrong with your code in the background, finding things that are maybe hard for humans to find, but are not so hard for computers to find. As an example, you're working on some code and you get a little message nearby that says, hey, you know what? This code is really similar to code that I'm seeing in a few other places in the solution. We could take all of these different methods and bring them into one in an ancestor class, as an example, with maybe only a few minor changes. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is, you know, I think we'll definitely see things like that in the future where you see, you know, more assistance, more pointing things out that are not obvious, that are hard to see. Because right now when we write code, Scott, we're looking at a small, almost a postage stamp, you know, size window relative to the entire, you know, book, the stamp book of code. Right. We're looking at a single screen and one file that can be one class out of, you know, thousands. And being able to go out and detect, you know, potential problems and alert, you know, and show those to you in a way that doesn't distract you from what you're doing, I think is also something that you'll see in the future. So. That's long term.
One of the things that, and I've got to talk about the competition, right? Because I'm sure. Going to be an unbiased journalist. But WeSharper, it's pretty clear to people that it's a refactoring tool and it's a test-driven development tool, and they're kind of carving out their niche. Over the years, as I've used CodeRush and try to, like, you know, when you talk to a friend and you go, hey, CodeRush is cool, you should try it. And then they say, oh, great, all right, I'll check it out. What is it? I'm always like, it's kind of this thing, and it's kind of – the elevator speech is hard because it does so much. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's difficult? That it is kind of everything in the kitchen sink?
Yeah, I usually say, let me show you a demo is what I usually do. If I can get a demo going, that usually holds people's interest for a long time, and I can start showing them the different things that are there.
Because it lets you read code fast because it has visualizers. Yeah. It lets you write code because it's got all sorts of expansions and things. And then it's got the ability to refactor code.
Right. The thing is, though, Scott, I think if you tell somebody these things who's never used these things, their first thought is probably like, well, okay, you know, how do I know I need those? I probably don't need those things. Those aren't things I've ever really realized I've needed. Mm-hmm. Right. It's that. So that's one of the challenges. That's why a demo is usually better.
Okay. I'm just thinking about the idea that, well, one, of course, Visual Studio itself is kind of always going to be nipping at your heels trying to do similar things when it comes to like refactorings and stuff.
Right.
Although, you know, certainly slower, and there doesn't appear to be any danger for either CodeRush or ReSharper, you know, not being useful in the sense of you guys are so far ahead doing stuff that's so out there. I don't see Visual Studio eclipsing you guys in anytime soon. I'm just trying to understand that, like, whenever at this point, it's basically in the last couple of years when people say, "Well, should I use CodeRush or should I use ReSharper?" I said, "Well, you know, try them both, watch the demos, watch the screencasts." But it seems that amongst kind of alpha geeks, you know, kind of the folks that really demand performance from their system, everyone's using one of these tools. I think it's become clear that the Visual Studio Editor by itself isn't enough to really do crazy stuff with huge code bases.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that there's, you know, there's, I mean, if you think about what, if you think about just the number of refactorings that are shipping with Visual Studio, it's like, I think 7 or maybe 8 with C Sharp and 1, which is renamed with Visual Basic. The refactorings that we have are extremely useful. And once you get a sense of what's there, you realize that there are things that you do all the time and or things that would be really nice that you could do, that if you could do them with the equivalent energy investment of a whim, right? For example, you know, sometimes I'm writing code and I'm working on it and I'm thinking, oh, you know what? I want to take this and I want to move this over here, or I want to extract this, or I want to, let's take a look at this. And without a tool that makes it easy to do these things, to fix the code, what happens is this design debt, this technical debt accumulates, and you end up having code that's not as clean and doesn't give you as good of a feeling when you're working with it. And so you really want subtle changes like refactorings to be effortless to apply and to use. Mm-hmm. And once you start seeing these refactorings and you see where they are, you realize that yes, there are things you do all the time. You just didn't realize that there was a tool out there for doing those kinds of things. So yes, even though the alpha guys use it, it turns out that almost all developers could benefit from, you know, the functionality in tools like this. They can certainly work faster. There is a learning curve that is there, but the learning curve is, you know, I think both ReSharper and I know we certainly work really hard to flatten that out and to make it so that even programmers who've never seen a demo of CodeRush can go in and get something from it within a small amount of time of small investment. So we start getting that return on investment very quickly.
Yeah, it's cool. Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. Where can people learn more about the architecture and what you're doing? Like if people want the technical details, do they check your blog or do they check the DevExpress blog? Because I find this to be the kind of the most complicated and most interesting Visual Studio plugin that I've ever seen.
Well, you can find plugin tutorials actually on my blog. So it's at devexpress.com/blog/Mark Miller, I think is what it is.
Maybe I'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes. So whatever that link is. And then also if you just search for DX Core, you can find out where to download that if you're interested in writing plugins and learning more about that. And we also have a forum/newsgroup where people can ask questions about building plugins. And there's a lot of plugin authors out there that are more than happy to help out new plugin authors in terms of what they want to do.
Cool.
So that's where they can learn more about that. And then also, oh, one other thing, Scott, we should plug CodeRush Express because it's free and it's,
all right. It is true. It is free.
It's free and it's got, I think something like 60 refactorings in it. It's got, something like 20, consume first declaration features in it. It's got some cool navigation features, duplicate lines, some other neat features inside of there. So look for, you can Google CodeRush Express, and Express is spelled without the first E. It's just a capital X and then press.
Or you can Google it with Bing.
Or you can Google it with Bing.
Thank you for saying that. Now right. I actually have that on tape. I have you saying Google
it with Bing. Is that
going to
help you for your review period, Scott, this year?
No. Actually, someone was mad at me on Twitter. A couple of, not mad, but they were like, yeah, you've been really using, you've been pimping Bing too much. Someone was complaining. Because a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, I promised that I would, you know, I mean, I use Google Apps and I've been a Google user for a long time. But I said, all right, I'm going to use Bing for a month. And, I'm going to, you know, I didn't say I was going to blindly use it as a member of the Big Blue Monster and of the collective, but I said, I will try Bing for 1 month.
Yeah.
And, you know, darn it, it's working pretty well. I mean, they've had a number of releases since then, and the index is getting updated. And I find myself, for searches specifically, using Google maybe 2 out of 10 times. So Bing's getting it 80+% of the time for me. So plus I like the pictures and I like the news and the images search. So I'm using Bing for my homepage on a number of my machines.
Interesting. Yeah. So I like the pictures too. I've only tried it a few times, but I was, in my mind while you're seeing this, I'm thinking, well, you know, if you Google for great UI, you get my blog posts as like number one and two on Google.
Serious? Great.
But if you,
UI.
Great UI. But if you Bing it, I'm like number 8th down there. And so I'm like, yeah, I'm a little bit like, I'm like, come on, Bing guys, pop me up there, somebody. I haven't quite figured out what the secret is.
You've got to, it's like Google bombing when you have somebody linked to it. You need to get your friends and then you need to Bing bomb yourself. You need to have a lot of people link to you with that word.
There's a Bing bomb out there, huh?
Well, have you ever done the Google bomb?
You know, I've never done it, but I think you showed me one a while
back. Well, yeah, the best Google bomb is you go to Google and you type in French military victories.
Right. Yes.
And then you hit, I'm feeling lucky. And then Google says, did you mean French military defeats? And it's all, right. It's all really true. It's all a lie where someone got enough people to point to this other site. So yeah, Bing bombing or Google bombing is when you have a lot of people linked to a term so that you basically fool Google into thinking that the internet thinks something about a certain topic.
Is relevant. Yeah. Right.
And apparently great UI, exactly. Bing thinks you're 8th.
Yeah.
Which is very sad.
So anyway, you know.
Well, thanks for taking the time to chat.
I may switch over. Hey, you're welcome, Scott. It's been fun.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.